We are talking with Ian Crane about fracking and the globalist financial war against mankind. And I wanted to ask you, Ian, how intentional you believe that the ongoing destruction of the earth, well, sea and ecosystem really is. I mean, mankind is being poisoned, as you clarified at the end of the first segment, from all fronts, including chemicals that the Rockefeller-sponsored science and universities conjured up about, what, 100 and 150 years ago or something like that. Now men's and women's endocrine system is being disrupted with the use of these poisons. And basically, mankind is being altered and changed. And at the same time, the very environment that we're living in is being destroyed as well. How intentional is all of this, do you think?
Well, I think we only have to really look at the Georgia Guidestones, don't we? The Georgia Guidestones appeared in Elbert County, Georgia in 1982. They're attributed to a mysterious R.C. Christian. And I think there's some speculation in the local library in Elbert County as to who R.C. Christian might have been. I've even heard it mooted that it was Ted Turner who financed the stones.
Really?
But I think if it was Ted Turner, I can pretty much safely say that I think Ted's had a massive change of heart since then. But nonetheless, you know, the Georgia Guidestones, what is it, 8 modern languages, 8 ancient languages, spell out the major goals and objectives of those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of the planet. And number one in the list of objectives there is maintain humanity at 500 million in balance with nature. In perpetual balance with nature. Now, 500 million, I mean, that's sort of what, half the population of India today?
Yeah.
And they're talking about that as a number of people across the planet. They're effectively suggesting that there should only be one in every sort of 14 people actually on this planet. And basically, you know, they've stated categorically they want to be able to rule the planet. I mean, Zbigniew Brzezinski said it's easier to murder a million people than it is to control them. I said, you know, which really does sort of put it into perspective, doesn't it? You know, for these people, you know, they think nothing of this collateral. Where they take the advantage, if you like, is they know that humanity cannot even comprehend such thought processes. You know, because most of us, dare I say all of us, would be mortified if we thought that, you know, we were responsible for any action that caused somebody physical injury, let alone death. And yet, I mean, an example of the socio-psychopathy is Tony Blair. You know, Tony Blair was being interviewed by a political commentator. This is a couple of years ago now. And this was when it was, it had, in the British media, it had pretty much been sort of mooted that, it was evident that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So this interviewer said to Tony Blair, he said, "So, Mr. Blair, how do you actually sleep at night knowing that some 500,000 Iraqi civilians, mostly women and children, lost their lives as a result of a strategy based on weapons of mass destruction, which is subsequently proven to be totally false?" And Blair's response is very telling, because despite the sort of open question, what he focused on was the interviewer's reference to 500,000 Iraqi civilian deaths. And Blair simply said, without turning a hair, "Andrew, I think you'll find it was only 100,000.
Wow, how good for him. You know, I bet you was going to say, I sleep like a baby, no worries about that, you know? Thank you for asking.
Yeah, it is incredible. And yep. But it's, you know, not that it helps us to understand, but it sort of puts it in perspective. For these people, human life is nothing.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you here. I mean, basically, if we follow the outline that's on the Georgia Guidestones and kind of read between the lines, we're basically talking about a massive genocide and potentially, yes, even a ruthless destruction of the, you know, major parts of the planet. So that they will be able to, you know, run around in their little Garden of Eden where they can maintain humanity under 500,000 in perpetual balance with nature, and everything is going to be just wonderful. I mean, it's obviously sick, and but even the idea that they think that they can build something positive or good or wonderful with that foundation is amazing. I mean, is that a ruse? Is it just a big joke? They really don't believe that, it seems like. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, hey, it could be. You know, I mean, we can only try to comprehend how they're thinking and where they will next go in their strategic path. But, you know, can we actually ultimately determine their final goal? I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of speculation as to the origins of those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers. I mean, I myself have put forward the hypothesis, you know, based on the research, that, you know, this group believe themselves to be the direct descendants of the Nephilim. You know, they believe themselves to be of superior bloodline to pure humanity. They are of Nephilim human mix. And I believe it is, I think it was Aaron Russo who told Joseph Farrell that when he had met with Rockefeller actually confirmed that he believed that he was the direct descendant or the bloodline descendant of Tammuz and Nimrod, i.e. the demigods. Now, you know, whether there's any truth in that is almost irrelevant. It's what these guys believe, and they believe that this is what gives them, if you like, a mandate to do whatever it is they want to do. You know, they find themselves in a position where they have effective total control of the planetary resources. They can manipulate the economies of the country. They can manipulate governments. I mean, it is like their global game of monopoly. And these guys, they work on very, very long-term strategies. And, you know, one of the conclusions that I came to some years ago, and then as tends to happen, my conclusion, I actually read it then in a book about a month later by William Bramley, who had actually come to the same conclusion. And I came to the observation that these guys seem to believe that their consciousness remains here on Earth. And it was something that I'd read from the Sumerian tablets, from an interpretation of the Sumerian tablets, that basically talked about the ritual where once their physical vehicle dies, they had a ritual where they would pass that consciousness into an as yet unborn soul. And then, so effectively, that consciousness would then migrate into another physical vehicle that was due to enter into this realm through the normal sort of birth method. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, I mean, it sounds absurd to us, completely absurd. It's meant to sound absurd so that no one will take it seriously. But these guys actually believe it. And of course, they believe that they can identify each other through the fraternities in the universities. That's why, especially in the US, but also in UK, you know, that's why at the sort of red brick universities, the Ivy League type universities, they pay so much attention to their fraternities and to the selection and induction of people into those fraternities, because they believe that they're sort of actually sort of bringing in the old, dare I say old souls, but I think a lot of these people are soulless. But, you know, let's say the sort of migrating consciousness from their bloodlines. And, you know, these guys, when they get inducted into these societies, they know that all they've got to do is effectively do as they're told, and they will be very, very well taken care of in the physical, empirical, material realm. And this is how, of course, they actually control the people that aren't even part of the bloodline, because I don't believe for one minute that Tony Blair is part of their bloodline. In fact, I actually believe that those who do think they are part of the inner sanctum, I think they actually despise the humans who effectively behave in a treasonous way to their own race.
Yeah.
Well, in return for the sort of the trinkets of reward.
That's why I think they regularly seem to, you know, crack down on some of these, and they pick them off, Gaddafi or, you know, Saddam, or, you know, there's many other people as well who kind of do the bidding for these folks for a little bit, you know, even Hugo Chavez or, you know, people like that.
Maybe, or maybe, you know, they mount challenges that they just don't want to see sustained. You know, because there's no question, Gaddafi was challenging the globalist agenda.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think what happened there is that I think he wouldn't be in the position he was if it wasn't for the fact that they were playing ball for the longest time. But then when he sees through something, or he realizes that, hey, you know, I can get some stuff done here, or he just basically goes against the drain and think, well, I can take over or whatever, they swipe him off the map, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and we're seeing this now in Syria. And of course, I mean, they're absolutely gagging to go for Iran and North Korea. And you know, these will be the next sort of bogeymen of the mainstream media. But to come back to, you know, what we were talking about, literally about the agenda to depopulate, you know, obviously, if they were any more overt, people might actually latch on. I mean, there are those of us who would say, you know, can it really get any more overt? Yeah. But the reality is that the vast majority of people live in their compartmentalized world, believing that everything they read or hear in the mainstream media is in fact the gospel truth.
And those are the people that they really are concerned with, I think, the masses. It doesn't matter if, you know, a couple of 10,000, maybe 100,000, well, at this stage it's more than that, but nonetheless, I mean, a million here, they're kind of peanuts compared to the rest of the global population. And so I don't think they're too concerned with what they know or what they're talking about, not at this stage anyway.
No, I think you're right. And I mean, I think they enjoy giving us the finger. I mean, an example of that was the hoarding on the side of the bus in Tavistock Square of the 7/7 London bombings. You know, the hoarding on the side of the bus that were supposedly blew up there,
yep.
You know, without any scorch marks on it. But what was on the side of the bus was a hoarding from a film called The Descent. And what it actually said was outright terror, bold and brilliant. You know, and I mean, anyone can Google that. If you Google Tavistock Square London bus bomb, you know, you'll see the picture, the photograph of this. And this is them giving us the finger. Say, look, you know, we can even announce that this is terror. It's outright terror. It's bold. It's brilliant. And even though there's a few of you out there who know what we're doing, even if it is a few tens of thousands or even a few hundreds of thousands, it's not enough. You know, because we can do this kind of stuff with impunity, because the masses, we will simply keep locked down either through, you know, the economic pressures or the circuses of the soaps or the sport or whatever it takes.
Yeah. Well, the masses are ultimately supporting these people are controlling them because they're not saying anything against it. They're not speaking up. And I think the fact that they have, well, things at their disposal, like the atom bomb, for example, just shows that we have monopoly on violence. And sure, you know, you go ahead, you speak up, kind of thing, you know. So they're very bold, and they're very. But I think that there is another, well, quote unquote, war going on at the same time. I think there are other repercussions playing out in the larger context of what really is going on in this reality, and I think that they are slowly but surely, you know, getting what's coming to them. That's what I believe.
Oh, I absolutely concur with you. I mean, I think that, you know, one way in which we can look at this, Henrik, is as a game, and we should look at it as a game. It is a game, and their game is monopoly. They're looking for total ownership of the board. You know, we can achieve a hell of a lot more when we do what we do without anger and, of course, without fear. And I think that there is no doubt, as we've talked about in past discussions, that, you know, something is occurring, and there's many, many hypotheses as to what that is, which is giving us the opportunity to elevate into another level of consciousness, which doesn't in any way, shape or form detract from our opportunity to participate in the physical, empirical, material realm. But, you know, once we start to actually embrace and engage some of the latent capacity that resides within the right brain, you know, which operates outside of the normal time-space continuum, it is amazing what we can bring about. And I mean, this is another avenue, and it's certainly something, obviously, that as more and more people realize they have access to, then hopefully, collectively, you know, we'll be able to bring that to bear. And I really do believe that we can actually bring about the change. And I think it's going to come in a way in which we probably ultimately least expect it. But nonetheless, it's going to come about because we're all doing what we're doing. And because we are, I think, maybe not as fast as we might like, but we are actually serving to wake other people up. And we're sowing seeds. You know, we're not preaching. We can't preach. That doesn't get us anywhere. But we can drop seeds in. And then when people, when the time comes, when people actually realize that that seed that was sown, it's germinated, and they go, oh, my God. And of course, as we all know, once that first card falls, there's no going back.
Yeah, you can't unhear or unlearn what you've learned. Very difficult. No. I mean, they don't seem to care if they bring about, well, the you know, symbolically speaking, the apocalypse. In fact, this might actually be the intention to cause such immense.
Let's revisit that. Yeah, let's revisit that, because we're confused. They want to bring about the Armageddon. The apocalypse is something very different, because apocalypse simply means the lifting of the veil. And I think we are going through the time of the apocalypse. And that is that, you know, people are seeing through the veil. I think, you know, the ruling elite, those who think they're the rightful rulers, they've hijacked the word apocalypse. And most people associate the word apocalypse with Armageddon. But it's two very, very different things.
Very good. And, yeah, you corrected me. I did use the wrong word. So thank you for that, Ian. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think you're right in terms of what they are trying to do is they are trying to bring about an Armageddon, which they believe that they will survive, that they can decimate humanity, and then they can use the remainder of humanity as their slaves, which once again is a repeat of almost the origins of mankind.
I'm also reminded of, I watched it a while back, Things to Come, H.G. Wells, the Fabian socialist and eugenicist. Yep. And he talks about the, you know, this society of architects. Well, they're actually really Freemasons in the movie. They say it flat out, who rebuilds the world, you know, from the, I think it's from the Sumerian or Babylonian kind of cradle of civilization, that idea that they have after the apocalypse and rest of mankind has kind of reverted back to this kind of, you know, brutal kind of brute state, if you will. And these are the new people that are going to, you know, salvage and save the day pretty much.
Well, actually, that can be traced back to Marion King Hubbard and his Technocracy Inc. And of course, the irony is that Marion King Hubbard was also is also credited with being the architect of the peak oil mythology.
Ah, hmm.
But, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is Marion King Hubbard is also really the father of the Zeitgeist movement and the whole philosophy of sort of management through resources, resource-based management, you know, managed by the technocrats.
Yep.
There's no question. I mean, this is their wet dream. And I mean, we see this with things like the smart grid, the smart meter. I mean, anytime you see the prefix of smart used on something, be very, very suspicious.
Because it's very dumb and it will dumb you down if you use it. That's the point.
Exactly. That's exactly correct. And I mean, that's why, I mean, I'm sure at some point, if you haven't already, you'll have somebody on your show talking about, you know, the smart grid, the smart meters, and, you know, how this is going to literally impact on people's lives right down to, you know, the detail of what they're doing on a moment-by-moment basis.
Well, do they think that an AI system is going to basically run everything in an egalitarian way? And it seems to be kind of a delusion when you know, they don't seem to realize that someone is actually going to program these computers to do all this decision-making for them, you know? Who's going to do that? Is there going to be a backdoor? Is it going to be hacked? You know, there's a million of different things. But one thing that worries me the most when we talk about a resource-based economy is that, as far as I'm concerned, there's no other way into that method of you know, running things than to basically steal everything from everybody, just like we saw during the Bolshevik Revolution. There is no difference.
Exactly. This is exactly right. It brings us right back to this game of monopoly, total ownership of everything on the board. And, you know, what they have discovered, I mean, this brings us almost sort of nicely full circle, but, you know, what they've discovered with the shale gas and the coal bed methane and the method of extraction through fracking, what they've discovered is that they've got an opportunity here to access a phenomenal, almost limitless resource relatively cheaply, especially whilst the price of oil is around $92 a barrel, relatively cheaply, but at the same time, surreptitiously, they can destroy massive tracts of the earth. And of course, this comes back to the Agenda 21 issue of forcing people into smart cities.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is H.G. Wells' New World Order from the 1940s.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So they force the people into the cities. And, you know, the story that isn't being told by any of the governments right now, although I will take my hat off to, I mean, I'm no socialist per se, but I will take my hat off to François Hollande in France, because he has so far resisted all efforts to bring the shale gas industry into France. And France and Poland are the two countries that are basically sitting on the largest shale gas resources in the EU. And we'll talk more about Poland, because I think Poland is really on point here. You know, ever since they wiped out the Polish government in the air crash, that was a Polish government that was resisting the EU and IMF overtures. And once they got that government out of the way, then that's it. All hell broke loose. And that's when we see all the corporations moving into Poland. We see Polish society literally decimated as people knew it.
I wanted to just drop this quickly as well. I want to just carry on after this. But Norway, as you said, not part of the EU. But I'm just saying this. Look out, because allegedly EU officials has now been, you know, turning their wishful glance towards Norway's enormous oil fund. And I think in a few years, maybe 5 to 10, something like that, they're definitely going to in some way try to drag in Norway in this, or even through peak oil or environmental regulations, going to try to stop Norway from developing this further, kind of deflating that whole situation for them, but then later on actually move in and then try to grab the resources for themselves. So
yeah,
look,
they'll
out
do
for
it under some, you know, bullshit climate
regulation
claims.
Or yeah, sure, definitely.
You know, I mean, because I made the observation in a presentation 4 years ago. I said, ultimately, these guys, their game plan is literally to tax us for every breath we take.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, literally. You know, and so we better start practicing breathing slower, you know, depending on how much time we want on this mortal coil, because this is where these guys are going. And this issue of the fracking, I mean, if we look at what's occurred, particularly in Colorado, let me just focus on Colorado, because Colorado has been on point here for the last sort of 15 years. You know, Colorado, the land mass of Colorado is actually almost exactly twice that of England. Not the UK, but England. And yet the population of Colorado is one-tenth that of England. So you can start to see that what's been happening with the gas extraction in Colorado is it's generally been in the relatively thinly populated areas. And so the people that have been affected, I mean, whole communities have been affected. I mean, there's one film that I would encourage people to watch. It's from 2009. It goes up on YouTube, gets taken off, goes up, gets taken off. So you have to get lucky with it. But it's called Split Estate. And most people who are listening to this discussion, Henrik, will have probably heard or seen the film Gasland. And there's no question that's a great film. Josh Fox did a great job with Gasland. And, of course, the industry is about to release its counter propaganda to Gasland. It's called Frack Nation.
I thought it was Truthland.
Sorry?
Truthland, I read that there were some other movies they're going to release to counteract it.
Oh, is that
it.
Right?
Yeah.
Well,
so it's another one.
There's no question we're going to see the PR being ramped up. And, of course, then we've got the Hollywood version of sort of Gasland, which is Promised Land, which I think is due for release in about 6 weeks' time or so. But Frack Nation is going to be the direct attempt to counter all of the elements that Josh Fox presented in Gasland. Well, Split Estate is a documentary. It's a proper documentary. That's why nobody's ever heard of it. and the term split estate refers to the fact that the landowner literally owns the topsoil, basically. And that, I mean, in the UK, it's the crown that owns the mineral rights to gold and silver and the state to hydrocarbons. In the US, of course, it's the federal government that effectively owns all the mineral rights in most of the states. There are some states, I mean, West Virginia is one, where the landowner actually also owns the mineral rights. But in Colorado, it is split estate. In other words, the landowner only has rights to the topsoil. And the landowner does technically have the right to determine who has access to his surface area. But the oil industry has found ways to literally either browbeat, bribe, or simply ride roughshod over landowners. So Colorado today has 50,000 gas wells, 50,000, and an infrastructure, obviously, to support that. But that's, you know, okay, perhaps in an area that's fairly thinly populated. But nonetheless, those populations. And Split Estate focuses on the town of Rifle in western Colorado, where, you know, the people have effectively been forced out of the town because of contaminated water, contaminated soil, and contaminated air. Because once the frack process is unleashed into the geology and it opens up the pathways for the gas to migrate into the water table and then up through the soils, and into the air, and like I said earlier, because it's an aroma-free gas, then you know you don't know you're breathing it, and whilst it's not going to knock you out in 5 minutes, over a period of time, it's going to take its toll. And what you see in Split Estate, and like all things, not everybody's affected in the same way. What you see in Split Estate is the horrendous effects on the health of some of the citizens of Rifle, who unfortunately really left it too late to move out, and so the likelihood of them making any kind of full recovery is slim to none. In Australia, when I was in Australia last year, and I went up into the gaslands of northern New South Wales and southern Queensland, and once again, it's fairly thinly populated areas, so the oil and gas companies are riding roughshod over the local population. But one individual who, you know, I've had some contact with now, a guy called Brian Monk, and I would encourage people to Google Brian Monk and take a look at Brian Monk's YouTube channel, because he regularly posts short clips of what's going on in and around his farm. And he's shown that, I mean, his water's contaminated. He's had to set up like a Heath Robinson type kit to try and burn off the methane within the water, so that there's, you know, a little bit of usability of the water. But he has one scene where he's actually sitting at the dinner table on the veranda. And there's, now, bear in mind, there is no drilling or fracking on his property. So it's all from operations that are outside his property boundaries. And yet he's sitting on his veranda having lunch with a gas detector. And the gas detector picks up 10 gases that are not indigenous to the normal atmosphere. And this gas detector's, you know, basically just sounding off. And, of course, they're sitting there breathing this stuff. And then, you know, Brian moves over to the soil, and this was before the rainy season. He breaks the crust of the soil, holds the gas meter down to the soil, and it's picking up the gas that's just leaking out of the soil. I mean, this isn't normal. This isn't natural. And unfortunately, Brian's family have had to leave the farm because his youngest son was starting to show some very, very strange symptoms, and also it was affecting his behavior. And the doctors could not offer any diagnosis. And eventually, Brian came to the conclusion that it simply had to be related to the fact that, you know, they were living in a contaminated environment. So the family have now moved out of the area and they've moved south. But Brian is still staying on the farm because he knows that if he leaves the farm, the gas companies will be on the farm and they'll just start drilling his farm because there's nothing to stop them coming on there. And even though if people Google Lock the Gate, I mean, Lock the Gate is the umbrella organization in Australia for trying to unite the people and prevent the gas agenda being accelerated. But you know, they have limited success. I have my own thoughts as to why that is. But you know, the bottom line is that what is happening is the same in Colorado. The gas industry and the governments, they try and keep these issues local, just like they did with the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, you know, where even if you go 100 miles inland, you know, people 100 miles inland from the Gulf of Mexico think there's no problem because the issues are not being reported. And it's exactly the same in Australia and in Colorado. It's changing a little bit in the US now that they've moved into the higher density population areas of Pennsylvania. And obviously the local opposition in Pennsylvania is a lot more significant than it was in Colorado. And the US oil industry has openly admitted that it is employing former military PSYOPs specialists to counter the activism of the local population.
Who is this? Who's doing this? The company or the government or unison together?
This was at a conference in the US, and it was admitted during the course of the conference that you know, the companies that were doing, one of the companies that were doing the gas extraction, were employing former military PSYOPs personnel to help them develop strategies to deal with the local activists and local opposition.
Well, that's a nice example of a private-public partnership right there.
The same has been admitted in Poland. Because, like I said, you know, Poland is now the easiest target for the EU gas drilling process. And you know, Poland, once again, is a large land mass. In the scheme of things, it's relatively thinly populated. It's mainly a farming country. Well, once they start the gas extraction, then the farming culture of Poland will be destroyed. Mm. It's not if, it's will. You know, Francois Hollande has actually made the observation. He said that, you know, basically this technology is not only unproven, it's actually proven to have the problems that we know, that it does contaminate the water, it does contaminate the land, and regardless of the pressures, he's not going to permit it to get kicked off on French soil. In Poland, they can't wait to embrace it.
Yeah, I know. I think they will use Allende to go forward on the points that will, you know, reach forward, you know, on the collectivist Agenda 21 agenda pretty much. And then, next time there's an election, throw him out, get the next boy in there who's pro-fracking, and then here we go. Tippy-toe stepping forward, you know.
And of course, you're absolutely right. And this is why, you know, once they get the industry kicked off in one EU country, they'll basically then use their strategy of harmonization and say that, well, you know, if we're doing it in one country, there's absolutely no reason why we can't do it everywhere else.
Yeah.
So the targets right now, the primary targets in the EU are Poland, Ireland, and the UK.
Yeah, and that's what they're going to begin with. And this will be, just as you clarified, and I just want to reemphasize that again, this will, you know, be the incentive why people would want to move out and away from rural areas, because they can't do it. It's impossible. They'll move into mega cities, if you will, Agenda 21, and they'll be locked down and controlled. And who knows how far this will go. I mean, they've been even talking about, roads basically that will be blocked off. You can't even go out into the rural areas anymore. And I mean, this could just go on and on forever. But it's interesting how they're going to extend it to such a point where they're willing to destroy nature, destroy the land, destroy the water and the sea and everything else to get people to move off the land again, basically, and into the cities, Because, I mean, I believe in a way there's been a resurgence of people trying to, you know, the get out of the city, the, you know, green yep. movement and or you know, organic, the whole nine yards, if you will. And now this is how they're going to do it. They're going to force people off with this incredible destructive mentality. It's absolutely horrendous.
Well, it started, you know, let me just tell you one of the remarkable things that's occurred in the first five presentations that I've given. You know, people, obviously, they listen, they look at the evidence I'm presenting. I show videos of what's happening in Colorado, in Canada, in Australia. And of course, people are just stunned, you know, because this is not what they're hearing from the mainstream media. All they're hearing from the mainstream media is that we got to, you know, get the gas. And they're using, you know, the even motoring commentators like the famous Jeremy Clarkson, who wrote an article that had a headline, you know, we need the gas, so frack off, Swampy. and Christopher Booker writing in The Telegraph, you know, I think Christopher Booker got it so right on the climate change agenda, but, you know, he's got it so wrong on the fracking agenda. But all of the information that's being pumped out in through the mainstream media is that anybody who objects to this is just an out-and-out extremist, and you know, you should listen to them. So I don't expect to get too far through the tour before I find that, you know, there are some you know, pretty outrageous articles being printed to try and counter what I'm doing as I go around the country. Let me just give you an example. The one area in the country that in England this is has been fracked is the Fylde Peninsula in the Black, just outside Blackpool. Two frack jobs were run, and both resulted in seismic events, i.e. minor earth tremors. Now, what is being reported in the media is that activists claim or allege that the earthquakes were caused by the fracking. Well, Quadrilla have admitted that, in fact, the statement is that the earthquakes were most probably caused by the fracking. Now, for a company to write that they were most probably, basically, that's corporate speak for, yeah, it was us. So the earthquakes were caused by the fracking. Now, some friends of mine live in the area. They have a beautiful five-bedroom house in Portland-le-Fylde. They decided immediately after the earth tremors that they needed to get out of the area while they still could. So they had their house valued. It was valued at £325,000. So they told the agents that they wanted to put it on the market at £250,000 because they wanted a quick sell. All the agents said, oh, you can't do that. You'll upset the market. And they said, well, you know, then find us a buyer quickly and get it off the market. Well, the house has been on the market now for over a year, and they haven't had a single offer. And in fact, the property market in the area is completely dead. They've actually managed to let their house now. And it was let because it's been let to a couple who are both from the area. They both were living alone with children. They've got together. And so they needed a bigger house as opposed to having the choice of 2 3-bedroom houses. They wanted a 5-bedroom house. So they're renting my friend's house whilst they're having to rent out their own houses. So this is how the market will be. So what actually gets people's attention is not so much the water contamination, the soil contamination, the air contamination, but the fact that their property value is going to absolutely tank. And this is, of course, like you rightly said, Henrik, this is what will drive people into the cities, because, you know, people who live in the 64% of the UK which sits over shale deposits, they're going to say, okay, well, we need to get out of here while we still can. So where can we go that isn't going to be fracked? Oh, we'll go to a city. So what's going to happen is that inner city housing prices are unfortunately going to become totally outrageous and unaffordable, whilst property prices in the gas fields are going to effectively become worthless.
And all of this is, of course, at the end of the day, a completely useless, you know, discussion, really, an idea, or, you know, event that's taking place, considering if we could just realize that there are alternative technologies out there. But no.
I mean, the alternative technologies, of course, are all owned by the oil and gas industry. And this is the strategy that was adopted by John D. Rockefeller right from the get-go. But, you know, so we've got two issues here. One is that we've got to find a way to get these alternatives out from under the clutches of the hydrocarbons industry. Because, you know, the way it works right now is people think that there are serious efforts to bring alternatives to market, but there are not. The hydrocarbons industry works on the basis that it will allow 8% of the total market for alternatives to make it look like it's interested in developing alternatives. The only reason it really is interested in developing the alternatives is so that it can acquire them and shut them down. So this is the cycle that operates. You know, they know that, you know, the windmills don't work. They're an eyesore, but at least they don't, apart from the noise issue, but at least it's not poisoning the land. Although there are those who would argue that, you know, livestock can't survive in these areas, et cetera, or is traumatized by the low hum that's caused by these. But, you know, nonetheless, it's not poisoning the land. But I'm certainly not an advocate of these outrageous wind farms that are cropping up all over the place.
Yeah, that's also very strange. It's changing the landscape, and these tripods, it looks like something out of another H.G. Wells, you know, movie.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like an alien invasion of sorts when I look at it. It's ugly. It's incredibly ugly to me.
But even if we stayed with hydrocarbons, you know, the alternatives are there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question. I mean, even methane hydrate, subsea methane hydrate, you know, I mean, the Japanese have really, I think, pioneered this. But I don't actually have an issue. I mean, apart from the fact that I do have an issue with the whole hydrocarbons agenda. But let's assume for a moment that we're locked into this hydrocarbons economy. I don't have an issue with fracking in a subsea environment. I have an issue, a mega issue, once you start bringing this process onto land. So, you know, we could be, first of all, extending the life of the reservoirs, the offshore reservoirs, but we could also be focusing on the development of subsea methane hydrates, because ultimately there is more methane hydrate than there is shale gas and coal bed methane. So it's when you start to put these things together, you say, so there's more methane hydrate in the subsea reservoirs than there is land-based shale and coal seam gas. So why are they focusing on the land rather than the subsea? Well, of course, one is cost. You know, the cost of accessing the stuff that's under the land is a lot less than the stuff that's at sea. And the same with, obviously, the ongoing maintenance costs. But once you actually then look at the environmental damage, and the not just the eco side, but the genocide that will result, you start to say, well, you know what? Actually, maybe that's their purpose. Maybe the real reason that they're now targeting the land-based shale and coal bed methane is because they can get away with fracking it, and they can get away with, you know, the cheap cost of production, but at the same time, they get this double benefit. Because they also get this surreptitious opportunity to annihilate the population.
Yeah. This is another perfect example of how government protects us with their regulations and rules. You know, they have our best interests at heart to help protect us and the environment, and they're doing a great job to keeping us safe. So my suggestion is, Fire your government and read up on it. Get informed and make sure that you don't support the companies that are involved in this destruction. And eventually you shut them down, even if, you know, the government is trying to bail them out with your money. Or, Ian, is it so that the game of monopoly is now so far gone that there no longer are any competitors out there to be able to support alternatives to get oil and gas from, while, you know, majority of people are trying to get off of that energy source altogether?
Well, that's it exactly. I mean, in the short term, I think what we've got to do is we've got to do what we've obviously all been doing for the last decade or so, which is continue the process of education and encouraging people to, you know, take a look at this stuff for themselves. And, you know, as is always the case, I don't expect anybody to take anything I've said during our discussion at face value. They've no need to, because, you know, they have access, at least for the time being, to the various search engines, and they can go and find for themselves everything that we've talked about tonight. And of course, you know, the beauty of the Red Ice audience is that it is an educated audience. And, you know, in many cases, of course, we are singing to the choir. But if we can encourage people who are aware of this stuff to sow the seeds with the, you know, the people around them. Like I said, I know, you know, from the correspondence that I've received from the people who've come along to my first five Fractured Future events, they go away and they share this information with everybody they know because it is so serious. Because they're starting to realize that there is an agenda to literally turn large tracts of the English countryside into uninhabitable wastelands, which will literally be used by the corporations to do whatever it is they want to do with. I mean, just like Australia is being turned into the world's mine, and much of it, of course, is now owned by the Chinese. I mean, I literally see a situation in Australia where within sort of probably less than 100 years, it's simply a whole bunch of coastal camps providing the dormitory and the R&R for people working on the extraction industry. Mm. And, you know, just to show you how absurd things are, because the other issue with fracking is the amount of water that it takes to run a frack job. And in Australia, the Australian government have given the extraction industry the right to use 500 million gallons, sorry, billion, 500 billion gallons of water a year from the Great Artesian Basin.
Wonderful. Thank you. You know, thank you.
Now, it needs 84 billion a year to replenish.
Yeah.
Right? So it needs 84 billion a year to replenish, and they're extracting 500 billion, half a trillion gallons of water a year. So how many years do you think it's going to be before the Great Artesian Basin runs dry? In the UK, we don't have that kind of resource. We don't have a Great Artesian Basin. Well, not one that we know of. So consequently, we live in a country that literally goes from feast to famine regarding water. In fact, a year ago, the whole of the country had been in drought through the winter months. I know that seems absurd now, but a year ago, the UK had been in drought. And in May of last year, at the beginning of May 2012, the British government was laying the seeds for the announcement that there was going to be a hosepipe ban right across the country and water was going to be rationed. Then, of course, the British summer kicked in and, you know, we've lived in a deluge ever since. But each well requires on average about 4 million gallons of water for the drilling and the fracking process. Now, that's an average, you know, because in Illinois a few weeks ago, there was a record set with a well that was fracked and it took 21 million gallons of water.
Wow.
Now, let's assume that 4 million gallons is the average. You know, we're talking hundreds or potentially thousands of wells on these gas fields. You know, where's this water coming from? You can't use seawater. It has to be fresh water. And of course, that fresh water is immediately contaminated with an average of about 5% frack fluid.
And there was radiation now also in some of these, radium, right?
Well, radium, radon. I mean, obviously, once the water has been in the geology, it is in some cases, yes, the water can come out with debris, which is radioactive. And of course, the water that comes out of the well, which is called the produced water, I mean, which is again a misnomer because it's not water. It's not water. It's water contaminated with frack fluid. It's like calling rat poison sugar. You know, it's not sugar. It's rat poison, but it has a high content of sugar. And one of the phrases that we're starting to see in the British media now is water-rich frack fluid. You know, which is, of course, not a lie because it is water rich. 95% of it is water and sand and silica. It's the 5%. But when we're talking 5% of 4 million gallons, 5% of 4 million gallons is 20,000 gallons. So that's 20,000 gallons of toxicity that's being pumped down the well. Only a percentage of that, and no one can calculate what percentage it is, will return. And of course, what does return, as you rightly say, does come back with debris. That debris can be radioactive. And in the US, for part of the problem in the US has been that for the last 50, 60 years, but most significantly the last 20 years, they have disposed of the produced water, i.e. the frack fluids that come out of the well after the frack job, in what's called evaporation pits, which is simply a hole in the ground lined with plastic. And then this toxic fluid is pumped into this pit and simply allowed to evaporate. And of course, if you happen to live downwind of an evap pit, then you're getting the full benefit of everything that's in there. Mm. Now, at least in Europe, as far as I understand it, certainly in the UK, but at least in Europe, we're not going to be subjected to the evap pits if this abomination actually gets underway. And in fact, right now, it's a little bit woolly, because the companies that are going to or planning to frack are still saying, well, we're still talking to various companies about treating and reprocessing the frack fluid, because some of it we can use again in future frack jobs. But that which we can't salvage will be treated and then disposed of safely, which basically means pumped into rivers, into canals, or into the sea. But let me tell you that the company that dealt with the produced water from the first two frack jobs that Quadrilla ran in the north of England have stated that they do not want to even tender for any future work. But so where is this going to be kept? Well, in the short term, it's being proposed that it's kept in double-skinned tanks. But in the US, of course, they've been pumping it underground now since the evap pit started to get some bad press. So what they were doing was they were finding disused reservoirs, and they were pumping the produced water into the reservoirs. And it's now believed that the phenomenal levels of frack fluid that had been pumped into these disused reservoirs have been the cause of earthquakes, significant earthquakes, in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So we are messing with something here that is outside of our technical competence. The geologists and the petroleum engineers, they claim that they've calculated that there's no risk, but the reality and the evidence suggests that there's no such calculation available yet. Because once this stuff gets unleashed underground, it operates in whatever laws of geology operate underground, and we don't have access to them.
Well, if they don't even know where the oil comes from or what it is, how can they know everything about the tectonic, maneuverings of everything that's going on down there? This could literally crack the entire surface field if it goes on long enough. The consequences could be, something out of a movie falling, crumbling like a cookie, who knows?
Henrik, look at the Louisiana sinkhole. The Louisiana sinkhole started out as a little bit of subsidence, and basically it's been growing at a phenomenal rate. I believe it's now the size of about 10 football pitches. Of course, the locals in the area have accepted now that they will never, ever move back. And the geologists cannot explain what's occurring here. I mean, they're putting forward all kinds of hypotheses, but they really have no idea. I mean, in the worst case scenario, Louisiana could literally disappear down its own proverbial butt.
Yeah. Wow.
In addition, we've got the aftermath of the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. I'm still of the opinion that well has not been stemmed. When we look at the magnitude of damage in that area, not just to the Gulf of Mexico and to the sea life, but to the to the local population, and I said right from the get-go that was a population reduction event, and everything that I've seen since actually continues to support that hypothesis.
Tell us about Sharkey, by the way.
Oh, Sharkey, yes. This is remarkable. It was in today's Sun. This is the Sun newspaper in the UK. And I opened it up and I'm flicking through it, because the reason I read the Sun, let me tell you, the Sun is allegedly read by 13 million people in the UK. And the reason I read The Sun on a regular basis is because by reading The Sun, I know what 13 million people in this country believe to be the God's gospel truth. So it's an important propaganda tool. In fact, The Sun has, as I think, determined the outcome of every general election in the UK, or certainly at least helped the manipulators get close to where they want to be, you know, probably for the last 30 years. But here on page 27 is a picture of a two-headed shark. And as soon as I saw the picture, I thought, you know, this is either from the seas around Fukushima or the Gulf of Mexico. So then I get to the caption, and the caption reads, "Here's a genuine monster of the deep, a shark with two heads. The baby bull shark was caught by astonished fishermen in the Gulf of Mexico."
Yeah, how about that?
I mean, you know, I'm very careful today. I still like my seafood, but I'm very careful about sourcing it. and again, you know, it's what we talked about. It's part of the agenda. You know, after the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, a lot of the seafood that was purchased in the US obviously came from the Gulf of Mexico. Well, after the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, people were not buying seafood from the Gulf of Mexico. So in late 2010, the Pentagon actually stepped in and was buying up the seafood from the Gulf of Mexico and selling it through their military concessions.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Yeah. So the toxic food from the Gulf of Mexico has been served up to U.S. military personnel right across the globe.
I say thanks for doing the bidding for the elitist globalists. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, you and I, Henrik, and the vast majority of the people, you know, listening to our discussion, have a pretty good idea of what's going on. You know, we have a pretty good idea of the pieces of the jigsaw. We might not yet be able to fit them all together to make the exact picture, but we're not a million miles off. And our challenge, literally, our challenge is to get humanity to understand what's going on here. And ultimately, the way that we get ourselves out of this mess is through non-compliance. It's through not playing their game. It's through stepping outside of their control grid, yeah, stepping away from their matrix in whatever way we can. You can't just sort of do it in one fell swoop, but there are ways in which we can step out. There are ways which we can become less reliant on the matrix, less dependent on the matrix, and more independent. And it takes enormous courage to do that.
Indeed. I mean, we can't expect to do it all over one day as well. People get overwhelmed, exactly, and they just, you know, what can I do? You know, it's like you begin with one little thing every day, or whenever you have the capability of doing so, changing out something, changing a routine or a habit that you know is no good or supporting, you know, the wrong sources that we've been talking about here so far. And you do one thing at a time, and you do what you can, and you don't get overwhelmed and feel guilty or anything like that, because, you know, you can't do anything at once, because that's just the way it is. We're, I mean, depending on where we are in our, you know, unfoldment of learning all of this and getting into the information, we'll be at different stages, you know, all of us. But there's always something that can be done. There's always an option and always a way out of things, I believe.
Absolutely. And, you know, what you guys have done with Red Ice over the last sort of few years has been absolutely fantastic. I mean, you have a global audience. You cover a phenomenal range of subjects. You know, there's no personal bias. There's no agenda. You cover it from every spectrum. And of course, the critical element is that you encourage people to look at this stuff for themselves. You're, yeah, planting those seeds. And, you know, you guys have, without any question, made a very, very significant contribution to the, you know, awakening process over the last few years.
Well, thank you for that, Ian. I really appreciate that. And you know, we can't do it without people like yourself, researchers who are out there talking about this, helping to spread the word and just, you know, continue your work as you do. And, I mean, we always really appreciate having you on, and we always learn so much. So thank you for your work, Ian, as well.
Well, it is a team effort. I mean, I and you guys, I mean, we choose to work alone, or, you know, or just with a small team around us, because, you know, that way we can actually pretty much guarantee that the only way we can get infiltrated is by ourselves. but, you know, right now there are the traditional environmental and eco groups picking up on the frack issue. And, you know, whilst I may have a very different opinion from these groups on some issues, I think that this issue of the fracking agenda is so significant, it's so important, that we have to put all of the issues where we have differences of opinion to one side. And to try and tag on other issues like climate change to the fracking issue is not helpful. In fact, it becomes the turd in the punch bowl. We have to focus on the central issue here. You know, we can debate all the other stuff at a future juncture, because if this fracking agenda kicks off, it's going to be a damn sight more difficult to stop it once it kicks off than it is to stop it before they actually get the drill bit in the ground. So we have a window here, and that window is probably only 6 to 12 months. And right now, you know, the company in the Northwest, Quadrilla, have stated that, you know, they're not going to do any drilling this year, or any fracking this year. They're going to put it off until 2014. Well, the reason they've said that is because they're waiting for legislation to be introduced, which is going through Parliament right now. It's called the Growth and Infrastructure Bill. And it's supposedly being put into place to remove a lot of the bureaucracy and the red tape from small businesses, to make it easier to run a small business. But another side of this is what it does within the bill. What it will do is it will give the British government the opportunity to say, you know what, access to shale gas is so important to our energy security and to our financial well-being, that we are simply going to ride roughshod over all local opposition.
Yeah, look at that. Thank you. That's typical government, putting the stick in the wheel and preventing everyone else from getting in there. This is the personification of that, of the, you know, that government corporatism, of that, you know, joint marriage between them, so that, you know, they can pat each other on the back and just control and regulate everyone else out of existence, pretty much. And therefore, again, preventing people from finding an alternative or going elsewhere for this, basically. It's just, so mad when I hear this.
And it shouldn't be any great surprise, but there's an almost identical piece of legislation being pushed through in the states in Australia. In Australia, it's called the Early Intervention Bill. Which you might argue is perhaps a little bit more honest about what it is. And once again, it's about stepping in and stating that from a federal government standpoint, they will not tolerate any opposition from the state governments or any other sort of opposition groups, because it's a priority for the country and therefore it's going to go ahead. Mm. And, you know, I think we're going to see more and more of this type of legislation being forced in elsewhere around the world, because as people do wake up and realize, you know, what the fracking agenda really is all about, it is going to be more difficult for them to do it. But when you have to resort to direct action, which unfortunately is the situation in the US and in Australia, then to all intents and purposes, the game's lost. You're fighting a rearguard action. I mean, obviously, you know, David and Goliath, you know, the small group can always have a success, but it's just much more difficult. So that's why, you know, my message to the European listenership here is get involved, understand what the strategy is in your own country, and get out there and educate the other people. We must not allow this abomination into the European territory. You know, it's in the US. I really feel for the people in the US. It's very advanced in the US. There's 500,000 gas wells in the US. You know, and obviously people in the cities are feeling the benefit, because they're paying about a quarter for their gas what they were paying, you know, a few years ago. And that's the argument that's going to be trotted out here in Europe. You know, your reason you're paying such high gas prices is because you won't let us frack. No, the reason we're paying outrageously high gas prices is because the socio-psychopaths that are running the gas companies are taking outrageous bonuses.
Yeah, yeah. And they're just getting started. I mean, as you say, I mean, if people think it's bad now, just wait. I mean, with the immense power that people have granted to governments, they will continue to enforce whatever ridiculous rule or law that they can down the road. And I don't think we've seen anything yet. And at the end of the day, this is why it's so dangerous to give so much power to government, because it can end up in the hands of anybody. And ultimately with the police and with military They are the ones who will enforce all this stuff. I mean, at this point, anyway, there's no companies out there that can, well, there's the rise of private armies and all that kind of stuff to mercenary stuff. But ultimately, it's granted by the monopoly violence of the government that sanctioned this kind of behavior. So be very, very, very careful, where you put your kind of trust at here in this scenario.
Well, the next stage of the game is actually to replace the national police forces with effectively private thugs. In the UK, the companies that are in the forefront to tender for these contracts are the likes of G4S, which is the company that, its claim to fame was the botched recruiting of security personnel at the London Olympics. But more concerning is KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, which is, of course, a division of Halliburton.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I can pretty much guarantee within 20 years, policing as we have known it will be a thing of the past. And we will be looking at private contractors policing our streets, and it will be little more than thugs. I mean, in France, they have the CRS, which is the riot police. And, you know, the joke when I lived in France, the joke in France was that when you applied to join the CRS, if you could spell your name right, you were overqualified.
Yep.
And you know, the CRS play the role. They're the riot police. They're only unleashed in that kind of situation. Well, you know, you just imagine that those kind of individuals are effectively the guys that are on the streets. It is nothing more than legalized thuggery.
Yeah, and I think it's just now coming to light of what it always has really been. It's worse than a mob. It's someone coming to you and saying basically, "I'll protect you. You know, I'll keep you safe." Takes your money from you. That's
and the way the corporations are getting the police to work with them is in Australia, when the local population are trying to blockade a particular site to prevent a rig getting on location or prevent the frack trucks getting on location. They bring in police from out of state. You know, they bring in the police that have no affinity with the local people.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, ultimately, what we're going to see, and we're already seeing the groundwork set for this, is as and when there is unrest within the EU, then the police will be moved cross-border so that the police can't even communicate in the same language as the people that they're supposedly policing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that will be even better for them. And that way they can really beat up the population. No problem, you know.
Well, you know, yeah. I appreciate that anybody listening to this, having never come across any of this material before, would probably be hanging their head, shaking their head, going, you know, what a bunch of conspiracy theorists. But of course, you know, the reality is that that term, which of course came from Ayn Rand's think tank, but you know that term simply demonstrates that the individual using that to dismiss the stuff we're talking about simply hasn't done their research. You know, because unfortunately, everything that we have been talking about over the past few years, and you've been talking to many others about over the same period, much of it has come to pass. And you know, we don't claim any special insight. We read the scripts. And we read the think tank reports. And of course, you know, some of the people that put their signature to these think tank reports, if the mainstream media published it, you know, people would be shocked. It would literally rock their worldview. And, you know, as Hitler said, you know, the greater the crime perpetrated by the leadership, the less likelihood there is that the people will ever believe that their leaders are capable of perpetrating such an event.
Yeah. Yeah. People will have to stop paying into all of this and consent to the behavior. And as you said, just as far as you can, remove yourself from it and stop supporting it. That's the only way that's going to, solve this issue. And also, as you said before, get together on the issues that are, you know, the most important at the time, help each other out. And in those cases, stand together to take care of an issue and don't let, you know, petty differences at that time divide you in that regard.
Yep.
And just like get it over with, you know, make sure it goes through. And then that can the group, if you will, can dissolve again. There doesn't have to be a set standard or a group that's ready or open to be infiltrated, as happens all the time. I think it's better with something that comes together for the issue itself, and then when that has been resolved or whatever, you have a dissolvement of it, and then later on, if there's a new issue, get together again and do it over again, you know. And then we can have differences and opinions between all of those scenarios, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the day we stop being the perennial student, you know, we can always learn something. You know, the day we get totally attached to a dogma, we've got a real problem. You know, you and I would change our opinions tomorrow in the if the appropriate evidence was submitted and was clearly clearly verifiable. But you know, in the interim, you know, we have a particular point of view, and that differs from some other people who are also interested in this. But because we differ on those issues, let's put them aside. I absolutely concur. I think that's the smartest thing that we can say at this point is let's focus on those issues which unite us and ignore the issues which divide us, because the issues that divide us will be jumped upon by the establishment and by the oil industry to try and break this challenge.
Oh, sure. Yep. They will push those buttons all they can. And look at this, look at this. It's what you said before, you know, if you're against fracking, you're an extremist, you know, and people are... you know, they don't divide people or you know, we do to ourselves, of course, but we don't draw the line between reasonable and unreasonable, it seems like, anymore. It's if it belongs to a particular camp, you know, is it to the left? Well, then I agree. Or if is it to the right? Yeah, then I agree on that. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. And that's what people can't do that anymore. These concepts of how to polarize the population is crumbling. They're falling apart. There isn't such a thing as left and right if you look at it anymore. It changes constantly. What is, you know, conservative or what is revolutionary? I mean, these are things that change all the time. So you can't be tied down, as you say, into a dogma like that. You have to open up. It's a bigger world out there, you know?
Well, two examples of that is, I mean, in Spain, where locksmiths, and a locksmith can come from any sort of part of the political spectrum, but the locksmiths have basically got together and said they are not going to participate in evictions.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, and in Ireland, the people are getting together to prevent evictions. You know, they're just coming together en masse and effectively blockading a property and preventing the bailiffs from getting to the property. Yeah. You know, this is people coming together in social harmony against the hegemony.
And they take a stand in the area that they can as well, where they do have a position of, quote unquote power, you know, they have some influence or something, whatever you want to term it. They take a stand in that and they make a moral decision of what they consider to be right or wrong, you know, and that's great. More of that, for sure.
Well, hey, Henrik, the game goes on, but we've got a long, long, long way to go. And, you know, we've also got to recognize that we're up against a very, very formidable opponent, but they are not unbeatable.
Very good. We'll leave and round up on those words. Very good and very encouraging, Ian. Thank you again for your time today. I want to make sure that we wrap things up properly with you giving out all your details about your upcoming talk, websites, and also as well, of course, give us information if there's any of the, you know, DVDs that you have out there that you want to plug to people who are new to your work that want to get into this or some of the other topics you cover out there as well. So please go ahead and give us that detail.
Okay. Well, the Fractured Future Tour runs from April right through to mid-July. It's 50-plus events around the UK and Ireland. And obviously, we will be talking about all issues that are occurring right now. I always ensure that my presentations, you know, pick up on what's occurring right up to the minute. So no two presentations are ever identical. But the core element, of course, is going to be talking about the fracking agenda, and trying to ensure that people in the UK and in Ireland actually understand the prognosis of what will occur if this kicks off. The website to go to is www.ianrcrane, that's I-A-N-R-C-R-A-N-E, ianrcrane.com, and you'll find the full schedule. Tickets can be booked online. They're £8 in advance. If people want to pay on the door, it's £10 on the door. The DVDs, well, the two sets of DVDs that are on my website are from two events that were held last year. There's the Financial Terrorism event, which we held with John Perkins and Max Kaiser. And then a smaller event that I did at the end of the year called On the Cusp of the Apocalypse. And both of those sets of DVDs are very, very relevant. And for people who, you know, perhaps want to get a sort of broader perspective, because it's not just me, it's John Perkins, Matt Kaiser, Brian Gerrish, Patrick Henningsen, Ben Fellows. So that, you know, multiple speakers speaking on these topics, coming at things from slightly different perspectives, and it really will give you a good insight in what we believe is actually occurring right now. And of course, we've developed that theme quite extensively tonight.
Indeed, great. Now, I hope you have a good tour. I hope we have a lot of folks coming out, attending, supporting your work and the talks that you're doing. So have a blast at that, and thank you again for your time, Jan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Henrik.
Well, it's always great to be able to speak to you, and I hope to do it again soon. You're welcome to tune in again. We'll be back with more in just a few days. Radio 314 is up next with Mike Cleland. And on Red Ice Radio, you'll be able to hear Kevin Barrett, Graham Hancock, Dean Clifford, Chris Thomas, and many more. I hope you have a great rest of your day, or if it's evening, have a good night, and stay on target. We'll talk to you soon.